listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Although it may not be the final battle in the Syrian conflict, a large battle looms that may well determine the outcome of the nearly eight-year-old war that's taken place in that Middle Eastern country. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international affairs. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday.
We've seen the Syrian government and their allies clean up the last of the rebels in the very south of Syria on the Israeli and Jordan border. That game has been finished. So there are three holdout regions in Syria that are not only significant, up till now, only the low-hanging fruit has been taken. These were rebel groups in the Damascus suburbs and in East Aleppo, groups that were easily surroundable, cut off, had stretched supply lines, and so on. There are three major areas of Syria that the Syrian government has yet to retain. The first up to bat is Idlib. In Idlib, which was taken over from the government in 2012 by a combination of the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army, al-Qaeda, then operating as al-Nusra, and ISIS, which was cooperating with both of the above at the time. That's right. You know, U.S. backed rebels were allies with ISIS before they were against it. Idlib fell back then, and since then there has been a struggle. Idlib is a mountainous region on the Turkish border. It is not very well economically developed, but of course it is strategically important. And right now, it is a hotbed of somewhere between 70 and 100,000, depending on you how you count them, heavily dug in heavily armed jihadis, both from Syria and from around the world. There's Chinese Uyghurs there. There's Turkmen. There's a significant amount of Chechens and other Islamic jihadists from the Caucasus. The Western press is repeatedly referring to it as the final rebel stronghold, and that's if you count Al-Qaeda, which is the dominant force there, going under now under the moniker HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which even the U.S. government says is just rebranded Al-Qaeda. They are long the dominant force in Idlib. They have there have been a series of conflicts inside Idlib between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, between Al-Qaeda, HTS, and many of the other jihadi and more mainstream, simply radically Islamist forces backed by Turkey and the U.S. And Al-Qaeda has always rolled out on top. Usually the fighting ends with some announcement of basic suzerainty given to Al-Qaeda. You know, there have been an attempted assassination of a number of leaders of all different sides, but always Al-Qaeda has emerged, and right now they have emerged in Idlib as the umbrella force under which all the others fight. You know, there really is no question about that. The other two areas, of course, are the Turkey's invasion and occupation zone in north central Syria, the Euphrates Shield region around Jarablus, which now extends to Afrin and Manbij. This was previously controlled by the Kurds. Turkey invaded it and has set up a proxy government there, along with a new Syrian army, which is ex-groups of the Free Syrian Army, other Islamists and jihadists, which are now, jumped up in Turkish uniforms. And Turkey is not going anywhere. They are teaching the kids Turkish in schools there. They have raised the Turkish flag alongside the Syrian rebel flag along buildings there. They have set up branches of the Turkish post office. And this is all on Syrian territory, deep in, Syrian territory. The other area, of course, is the U.S. and Syrian Democratic Forces, which is to say the Kurdish-controlled East Syria east of the Euphrates. And the U.S. is also digging in for the long haul there. They've got no indication they're leaving. They've set up a number of military bases. And in the past week, they have secured an additional couple hundred million from Saudi Arabia to finance there. Trump was always against the idea because of the cost. Well, Saudi Arabia has agreed to foot the bill. What's interesting, of course, is that the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds in East Syria, are at odds with both Idlib and Jarablus, which both fall under the Al-Qaeda, the joint Al-Qaeda-Turkish area in North Syria, because of the problems that Turkey has with its own Kurds, which have been extended into both Iraq and Syria with Turkish, incursions into the sovereignty of both of those countries.
How far south is the Kurdish area that you're talking about? Does it go down as far as Deir ez-Zor, or is it more up like Hasaka?
It extends all through East Syria.
Wow. So along the Iraqi border.
From north to south. Now, in the south, you see a greater concentration of what are called local Sunni Arab tribes, which most of them are ex-ISIS tribes, tribes that had once owned fealty to ISIS and have been referred to and by U.S. military terms as rehabilitated ISIS. And they don't get along well with the Kurds. We have latently seen beginnings of, you want to call it, partisan warfare, uprisings, protests against Kurdish rule in Raqqa and other areas of East Syria that extend far beyond the very north where there is a Kurdish majority. So there are some definite conflicts beginning there, which once again shows the really futility of the U.S. position there. You can't rule all, you know, you can't rule central east and southeast Syria with Kurds. It's just not a long-term strategy. It can't work because the local Arab population has even indicated that they would prefer the return of the Syrian government from Damascus over the Kurds, at least a percentage of them there. And once again, it has to be said, most of these are ex-ISIS tribes. Tribes that, you can talk about the pressure they were under. Oh, they had to join ISIS and so on. You know, well, that has been the case there. But Idlib is front and center now. That is what the Syrian military and Russia and its allies have now focused on. And there's some potentially somewhere between, well, again, the numbers are not exact. The UN has a habit of exaggerating them by a factorial scale, but there is somewhere a potential between 1 and 2.5 million civilians in Idlib. And the immediate cry right now is you can't attack Al-Qaeda and their friends in Idlib because of the civilian casualties, the terrible human suffering. And we've heard this mantra many, many, many times before, except now we're expected to believe that the Syrian government should just allow an entrenched Al-Qaeda to control part of their country.
You know, this, by the way, bears absolutely no resemblance in scale or scope to the shock and awe that the U.S. visited upon Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. Okay, then civilian casualties from an aerial bombardment that was supposed to shock humanity and awe humanity, that wasn't a concern. Going after some jihadis in the middle of Idlib, you've got to watch out because there's civilians around there.
It's really ridiculous.
Let me scale this for people for a second, too, just for the map's sake. What we're talking about in toto here, the first two, where basically it's along the Turkish border in the west, northwest, and north central area, runs from, well, Idlib is between Latakia and Aleppo, almost dead center between them. Latakia being on the coast of the Mediterranean, the western part of Syria, and Aleppo going obviously easterly into it. I don't know, we're talking 50 to 75, maybe 100 miles into Syria from the Turkish border.
Yeah, pull up a Syrian map of zones of control on Moon of Alabama or something. It'll help you all to visualize this.
And then it goes, you run a widening strip along the northern border going towards the east border, which is with Iraq. And that widens all the way down to the main drag that runs through Deir el-Zor. And that's pretty much what we're talking about. So as you go into Idlib, what you're doing is going into this beast through the mouth.
Yes. And this is, once again, you know, we've all heard these magic green buses carrying jihadis that have surrendered in other areas of the country that have been reclaimed in the south and the suburbs of Damascus and Aleppo. Well, they've all been brought to Idlib, and now they're all here and entrenched, and I'm not so sure that was such a great idea.
Right.
Now, part of the whole rationale has been the Astana Agreement. The Astana Agreement was ostensibly between Russia, Iran, and Turkey, with, of course, the Syrian government playing junior partner in this to Russia and Iran, because the Turkish government still refuses to deal with them directly. Now, let me explain this to you. This is not because Turkey and Russia and Iran are allies in Syria. This is because Turkey represents the enemy. Turkey has been the quintessential factor in this war from the very beginning, because the rebels could never be armed, supplied, and trained where they were strongest, which is north, north central Syria, without Turkey. I mean, Turkey was turned into a jihadi Disneyland. You know, that's where they went to.
Right.
That's where they had their families, for the longest time and so on. The U.S. had MOMS centers. They were euphemistically, the acronym was there, MOMS centers in Turkey and Jordan that trained them up, gave them their salaries, you know, armed them,
right,
and then sent them into Syria. And what the Russia's rationale for this, Turkey started having problems with Obama because Obama was hesitating on a U.S.-Turkish plan to direct take the fight to bomb Damascus, to form free safe zones in northern Syria and follow the Libya change,
right,
regime change scenario back in early 2015. Obama was dragging his feet on this. Erdogan finally convinced Obama with the go-ahead, and then that is directly when Russia announced their intervention into the conflict in the fall of 2015,
right,
some 3 years ago, preempting and preventing direct regime change against Damascus when the proxies couldn't do it on their own. Turkey was extremely upset about all of this and hemmed and hawed, but they were upset at the Obama administration. They had difficulties. They had arguments with Saudi Arabia and so on. And so they eventually agreed to this Austin-Aw agreement, which particularly after the U.S. with the Trump administration dropped they had the CIA drop the Free Syrian Army, the direct arming of those, at least temporarily, although supposedly the taps are back on again now, and shift all the funding to what the Pentagon had previously backed, which was the Kurds. Now, never mind that the Pentagon backed Kurds and the CIA-backed Free Syrian Army, the Sunni Islamists, had been fighting for most of this war against each other, a proxy war between the Pentagon and the CIA in Syria. This big shifting, supplying, you know, heavy arms and everything else to the Kurds in East Syria really pissed Turkey off. Russia promised that they would respect their security concerns with regards to the Kurds. And then this elaborate geopolitical dance that is the Austin-Aw agreement began. And this is, if you can imagine it, as Putin and Erdogan waltzing across a ballroom with daggers poised at each other's back. And that is the Austin-Aw agreement. By it, Turkey hoped to justify their military incursion into Syria and basically carving off northern Syria and driving the Kurds, ethnically cleansing the Kurds out of it, and moving Turkmen and Uyghurs and everything else, all the Syrian jihadists from across Syria, they wanted to resettle there. And Russia hoped to cut all of the other backers of the rebels out of this process. We're talking Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, the U.S., France, and the U.K., at least the major ones. There are some other smaller bit players. They hope to cut them out of it because without Turkey, they couldn't supply the rebels, except for the Kurds in East Syria again. So, it was a dance, and nothing in this partnership has been honest from day one, but that is part of the geopolitical game. But it was always going to come down to Idlib, which is al-Qaeda, under the Turkish protection, and this adjacent, directly Turkish-ruled region of the Euphrates Shield Zone, which now stretches from Afrin all the way to Manbij, with Jarablus being the heart of it in between. Turkey has been trying to get all of the jihadi groups and Islamist groups in Idlib into one unified force. And Russia has actually, been encouraging them to do this in the hope that they could. The big problem with all the peace agreements that have occurred from the Geneva process to the Kerry-Lavrov has always been separating the moderate, legitimate rebels from the jihadists, from al-Qaeda and friends. Of course, this has always failed because there is no difference between the two of them. I mean,
right.
they I mean, they do have some slightly different hierarchies and goals, but they have cooperated together since the beginning of the conflict, since from the very beginning. And, you know, this continues up to this day. They refuse to separate. It should not be the onus on the Syrian government and Russia to separate the moderate rebels, from the jihadists.
Right.
When the U.S., the backers, and now Turkey has failed to do that as well. That was part of the Astana agreement, was that Idlib would come under its zone of influence. They've actually erected 12 observation posts on the borders of Idlib, which they have now reinforced. Not just these observation posts, by the way, as the Western media, as Reuters reported, were set up with the cooperation, the knowledge and cooperation, joint escort by HTS, by Al-Qaeda, the Turkish military, set up these observation points there. And so they've now fortified these observation posts with concrete barriers, which ostensibly could be used to protect them from the jihadis that they're actually working with, but also air defense.
Wow.
Now, Why is Turkey setting up air defense around Al-Qaeda-ruled Idlib? Well, to protect it. Not from Al-Qaeda, but from the Russian and Syrian air force.
Will they be using S-400s?
No, of course not. Don't get me started on the idiocy.
Sorry, I had
the insanity of selling S-400s to Turkey when we're de facto at war with them there. I still have hopes that this is some dramatic ploy to separate Turkey from NATO and so on, which is not going to happen, but at least estranged relations, and that Russia never actually intends to deliver any of these S-400s to Turkey next year. I hope that's the Turkey's setting up air defense to use against the Syrian and Russian air force to protect Al-Qaeda and Idlib. Now I want to highlight some articles here that I think that you should read.
Okay.
On all of this. And the first one is in Al Monitor. And Al Monitor is a very good view. They've got a number of Russians and Arabs writing for them there. And they're a very good view into this dance between Turkish and Russian relations without being completely overtly anti-Russian. And the article is Turkey Amasses Force of Syrian Rebel Factions at Idlib, by Fahim Tastikine, and that's at Al Monitor. That's the first one you should read. Then Moon of Alabama, our old friends there. New interests join the clash about northeast Syria from August 18th. Then from a little bit earlier, from Reuters, Syrian rebels build an army with Turkish help, face challenges. That was from August 12th. That's by Kahil Ashawi. Then, not that you want to take everything they say. This is from the pro-regime change, pro-jihadi point of view. But it's important to consider because they do have some insights. War on the Rocks. Charles Lister, writing for War on the Rocks. You might remember him from Brookings, Doha. He's still bouncing around there. He's essentially always been Ahrar al-Sham's unofficial spokesperson in Western academia. Charles Lister, War on the Rocks, The Urgency of Idlib, The Impending Regime Offensive and the Delicate Balance in Syria's Northwest. And then the last one I'll give you, again, from a pro rebel pro-Turkish point of view in foreign policy. Turkey has made a quagmire for itself in Syria. The Turkish military has discovered it's much easier to invade Syria than to govern it. And that's by Borzo Daragahi.
So there's
you read those and you'll have a good idea in English of what's going on there. And Turkey has set up several in the Jarablus Euphrates Shield Army. They have set up a proxy government and a new Syrian army. which is some 35,000, some of them ex-FSA, some of them former Ahad al-Sham, which is a jihadi splinter group off of Al-Qaeda that has been backed by Saudi Arabia before. 35,000 troops strong there, holding that area. In Idlib, they have set up a couple of umbrellas. And right now, you can talk about three separate allied groupings in Idlib. The first one is HTS, Al-Qaeda itself, which is the strongest. And then there's the Turkish set up National Liberation Front and the Syrian Liberation Front. And these are both different groupings of jihadis that have agreed to work together under some degree of Turkish control. Turkey's still paying their salaries, their arms, you know, everything like that. But they still retain a little bit of independence. Turkey's goal from the beginning has been to combine them, all the jihadis, including Al-Qaeda, together and put them in Turkish uniforms, new Syrian army uniforms, as their proxy military, proxy government force in Syria. Al-Qaeda, HTS, has been resisting this. They still cooperate with the Turkish government, but they're not willing to come completely under its control. So that is continuing on there.
Mm. So I'm taking a look through some of these articles here. And I'm going to just give people very quickly a rundown again. Backwards from Foreign Policy, July 13th, Borzo Daragi, Daraghi, Daraghi. Turkey has made a quagmire for itself in Syria. Then we have August 3rd, 2018, at waronthrocks.com, Charles Lister, the urgency of Idlib, the impending regime offensive, and the delicate balance in Syria's northwest. We have at Reuters on August 12th, Syrian rebels build an army with Turkish help, face challenges, by Khalil Ashawi. At Moonover, Alabama, and this is a very interesting one. Maybe we can talk about some of this for the next couple minutes we got left. This is new interests join the clash about northeast Syria. And then finally, the first thing that you had mentioned by Fahim Tasdakin at Al Monitor, Turkey amasses force of Syrian rebel factions at Idlib, and that was dated August 23rd. The thing that's interesting to me about this Moon of Alabama piece is it takes a look at some of the other things that are going on in and around Turkey and between the U.S., Turkey, and Russia, including the U.S. feud with Turkey and the currency crisis that's being created as something that might be driving Turkish policy.
Yeah, there's a conflict going on between the U.S. and Turkey, which started ostensibly over, of course, the larger concern is always U.S. support for the Kurds. But recently, there is a U.S. pastor, type of missionary, who is very probably CIA or a CIA asset, who was arrested and is under trial in Turkey. And he evidently, through friends, is an associate of Mike Pence, who has been pushing Trump to demand that Turkey returns this pastor, which is, Turkey regards as ironic, because they've long demanded this Falun Gong. This Turkish Islamist pastor that they claim was behind the military coup. I doubt that, but they say so. They've long demanded a pastor from the U.S. And in response, Trump has begun announcing tariffs and sanctions on Turkey. Turkey has announced reciprocal measures, and the Turkish economy, already deeply in debt and over leveraged, has tanked, and the Turkish lira is falling like a rock. So this brings up an interesting angle with all of this, is that in order to try to hold up lira, Turkey, which had early taken the Qatari side in the Qatari Saudi feud, and sent troops to protect Qatar from Saudi invasion. Qatar has offered a $15 million loan bailout to Turkey. Meanwhile, we talked about how Saudi Arabia has promised money to the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds in eastern Syria. So you now see Saudi and Qatar continuing their inter-Wahhabist feud amongst themselves with donations to opposite sides of the Turkish-Kurdish conflict that's ongoing and taking place, actually, in Syria.
This is the same war where we saw even the U.S. intelligence versus military having their own jihadis on the ground shooting at each other. In other words, where our taxes are going to Langley so they can hire some jihadis to shoot at guys who were there because our taxes through the Pentagon sent them onto the battlefield, and they were shooting and killing each other, both backed by the U.S., but on opposite sides of some divide that's there. We're pretty much out of time. Look, just going forward, you got about a minute. What should we be looking at sort of as a harbinger of when this thing is going to actually break?
Yeah, well, so the Russian Air Force has already resumed bombing of specifically Al-Qaeda controls of areas of southern Idlib, and the Syrian army is massing its forces to begin the offensive there. Turkey and its Al-Qaeda and other National Liberation Front, Syrian Liberation, are digging in, amassing supplies and ammunition and so on. There are two meetings of one of the Astana formats, another one between Putin and Erdogan, at the end of this month and going into September going forward, where they're going to try to come to some type of agreement here with Turkey, what to do with Idlib. Turkey just wants basically have it be a protectorate under their control. I can't see that either Russia and certainly not Syria are going to accept that. So there will be two possible diplomatic meetings that are intended to solve the impending storm in Idlib, but I do not have faith that either of those will be successful.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. On this edition of Crosstalk, we consider one question. Is Donald Trump's America First policy in contradiction to the Washington consensus idea of American exceptionalism? The answer to this question will likely define Trump's presidency and change the world in the process. Crosstalking American Exceptionalism, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Flanagan, in Washington. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. In Charlottesville, we have David Swanson. He is the director of worldbeyondwar.org. And in Northwood, we cross to Inderjeet Palmar. He is a professor of international politics at City University, London. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules. In effect, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to David first, because he's written a book on the topic titled Curing Exceptionalism. Okay, we have about a year and a half of this presidency. I'm getting a pretty good idea what America First means in the mind of Donald Trump, and I know very well what American exceptionalism is, and I'm not a big proponent of it. Is Donald Trump incompatible with his American First policies with Washington's insistence, grudge and digging their heels in very deep, that American exceptionalism must be maintained? Go ahead, David, in Charlottesville.
I guess the short answer is no, I don't see it. I look at what Donald Trump does in terms of foreign policy, in terms of continuing U.S. imperialism, and he is dropping more bombs, he is building more bases, he is getting more military spending out of Congress, demanding more military spending out of Europe, shipping weapons to more places, including Ukraine, continuing to insist on the U.S. right to do what it wants in places like Ukraine and Nicaragua and around the world. He's not switching policies, allowing the people of Afghanistan or Nicaragua or anywhere else to decide their own fate. I mean, the changes are all rhetorical and in terms of mannerisms and style. People abroad outside the United States who see him as radically different because he blurts out things he doesn't act on, like NATO is obsolete, seems to me as superficial as people within the United States who say the vote in Crimea to rejoin Russia was the big threat to peace and stability and the rule of law of the past centuries. I looking at actions rather than at okay. statements. I don't see it. He's continuing U.S. policy.
Good points made there. Michael, nonetheless, we have the reaction of where you are, the epicenter of the swamp. They see Trump as being very much a threat to the outlook that has been cultivated and enforced, I would point out, since the end of the Second World War, particularly since the end of the Cold War. So, I mean, Michael is right on all these points here, but that's not how the people that used to run the show see it that way, and they're pushing back against him in very peculiar ways, and particularly using the media to push against him. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think the swamp has a collectivist view, definitely denies American exceptionalism writ small, and that is America has the best workers in the world and we have an exceptional view of our future and we view ourselves as the shining light of the world. And then you have American exceptionalism writ large, which as a matter of foreign policy means that we'll run the world. I think writ small, Trump is a huge champion of that. Writ large, I think your other guest is correct. He's not a big champion of America run the world in the sense that we will make foreign policy for the world, but we will behave any way we need to protect our security, and that is often irrespective of what Nicaragua wants or what anybody else wants. And I think Trump is definitely a proponent of that. The swamp would rather have us collectively sit with the European powers, basically, Europe almost exclusively, and discuss what we need to do around the world while we pay the freight and they make the decisions. And I think Trump is trying to bring an end to that by threatening NATO, not as an institution like Eisenhower did, by the way, in his presidency,
yep.
but to say that it's not an organization that we're going to support exclusively and move on forward with.
Interesting, combined of what we've just heard from Michael and David. So America first and American exceptionalism, they've defined the worst possible elements of both, and they're being combined. That's what I've gotten from this conversation so far. Go ahead, in Norwood, Northwood.
I don't think I would violently disagree with the two colleagues that you've just spoken with. I think American exceptionalism is a particular kind of nationalism, and that nationalism has attached to it a great sense of a uniqueness and superiority. And to a large degree, it's also backed by power, but it's power behind certain kinds of values. And I think where President Trump probably differs from his predecessors, like President Obama and George W. Bush as well, is that in a way he's rejected the rhetoric of values, of democracy, of human rights, and promoting those kinds of liberal values in favor of naked power. So I would say that that's the principal difference between those two. There is also a strategic disagreement as well. And I think that largely is around the relationship that the United States or President Trump is building with Russia and the bigger geopolitical picture, I think, which he has in his mind, possibly urged by Henry Kissinger, the yeah. former Secretary of State, about some kind of a possible Russian-Chinese split. And I think there's a big disagreement about that, but that's a strategic question. I think overall, the United States continues to exert its power, but I think the rhetoric around values, I think President Trump doesn't have any time for that. He's much more about asserting raw, hard power of the dollar, of the trade market access, and of the American military.
Okay, well, David, I mean, I guess in a way, Trump is probably more honest than his predecessors because he doesn't talk about democracy promotion as, but that has always been a cover. I think only people in the swamp actually believe in that rhetoric anymore, forcefully bringing democracy to the world. I don't see where it works. No one's ever empirically proven it to me. But so really, it's the same thing. It's American exceptionalism with a different rhetoric. I guess, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Go ahead, David.
That's exactly right. The rhetoric has changed a lot more than the substance. The disagreement between the Make America Great Again people and the America Already Is Great people is not around the need for the United States to have double standards and a set of laws only for itself and superiority to the rest of the world. That is universally agreed upon in Washington. The disagreements are around rhetoric, around domestic policies, and around Russia and the demand from the Democrats. I wouldn't dignify it by calling it strategic. It's more trying to explain Hillary Clinton's loss and hating anything Trump does. So if he threatens North Korea, that's crazy. If he fails to threaten Russia, that's crazy. You know, the disagreement is around this mythical story of the evil deeds of Russia and their gargantuan significance in the context of the good U.S. law-abiding behavior. And there, you know, you can give Trump credit for refusing to bow to the Russia gators. Otherwise, I give him very little credit for anything thus far as he continues disastrous policies that are taking this country and the rest of the world over a cliff.
You know, the rhetoric is certainly different, but and some of the actions are too. I mean, I don't think any of us really took seriously that there would be a meeting with Kim so soon. Nothing much came of it, and now he wants to meet with the Iranian leader days before, in capital letters on Twitter, threatening it. I mean, Michael, how do you explain that? Or is that just expediency, the midterms? It's just the here and now, and worry about the implications later. Because I mean, from the outside looking in, this is very confusing, and we're supposed to be experts to be able to figure this stuff out. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think one of the hallmarks of Trump's foreign policy is that it's Trump. It's not a collective view of the State Department and with weigh-ins from DOD and other places and intelligence. It's Trump. And he's proven to be fairly adept at it so far. However, you may or may like the outcomes, he's gotten in with Korea. He's reworked trade agreements in Europe and elsewhere. Some of it has been to our total benefit. Some of it has been a conciliatory benefit. We enjoy a relationship with China we haven't had in maybe ever. I don't know that what he's doing is confusing bad, evil, wrong, or fattening, but what I do know is that it's in his head and it's been working thus far on the talking diplomatic level. And so I'm not prepared to throw it over just because I don't understand it.
I get your point
with that, which I don't understand.
I get your point. Yeah. I get your point. I mean, the way he sees the world here and his base. And I think, let me go back to Northwood here. It seems to me, even a year and a half in, Donald Trump doesn't have a lot of interest in foreign policy. He's made a group of promises on the stump, and he's committed to realizing each one of them. I've never seen it, a president so adamant going through his checklist, okay? Is it really his idea of American exceptionalism, American first, is it really domestic politics driving it for him?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there is a very, very great interest in domestic politics, and he has made a whole load of promises. And as you say, I think the first thing that Steve Bannon did when he entered the White House as his advisor was to put up a whiteboard and put a whole load of lists of the promises made and start ticking them off. But I think the foreign policy perspective that President Trump has is one of increasing American power and extracting as much value economically, commercially, financially, and so on from allies, associated powers, and from enemies. And I think all that is down to his long-term idea that America has been ripped off. Yeah. And I think if you look at domestic politics, then the kind of people he defines as core Americans, he basically is selling them the same message, that you have been ripped off, white American men in particular, by women, by minorities, by immigrants, and so on, and you've lost status. And what he's going to do is restore American greatness. And
I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We have American power abroad. I have
so
a hard break
there
here.
There is a sort of...
After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on American exceptionalism. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, David, you know, ever since Trump entered the Oval Office, a lot of us have been trying to understand if there's a rhyme or reason to his foreign policy. And I think that even on this program, it's kind of coming together. It seems to me it's kind of like going back to the 19th century great powers competition without all the values that that were pushed since the Second World War. It's just really kind of brute power and advantage and looking for competitive advantage. And it's very brusque. And it seems to appeal, just as Inderjit pointed out to us in the first part of the program, it does appeal to his base. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think, you know, it appears to be all Donald Trump. But just as, you know, Reagan and Gorbachev came out of the meeting and were told by their advisors, no, you can't get rid of nuclear weapons. Every time Trump has a good idea, like get rid of NAFTA or get rid of NATO, he talks to his advisors and it's off the table. I think that, you know, an actual break with U.S. exceptionalism is not on the agenda of Donald Trump or his advisors. I mean, it would look like joining the International Criminal Court, joining the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The United States is party to fewer major human rights treaties than almost any other nation on earth. It would mean giving up the veto at the United Nations. It would mean getting out of Afghanistan. There's a promise I'd like Trump to keep. I mean, this is a guy who promised no more of these wars and bomb their family, you know, kill their families, bomb the bleep out of them. So it's easy to say he's keeping his promise because he promised black and white. But the ones I'd like him to keep, he's not keeping, as well as, you know, a few like building the wall and locking up Hillary that I don't necessarily need him to keep either. But, you know, this is a guy who thinks he's running the world, and it's dangerous to what extent he is, but he's not overruling the weapons dealers or the big players in Washington, D.C.
You know, yeah, Michael, that seems to be very contradictory, because he said in interviews that the United States shouldn't be the policeman of the world, but in fact, it remains the same, okay? And particularly, you know, I mean, you look at the Korean Peninsula. I mean, a peace between the Koreas, denuclearization, maybe the American troops could go home, there'd be no reason for them to be there. And then the entire foreign policy elite has their hair on fire, like, oh my God, peace, don't let it break out, it'll change our world, okay? I mean, it seems to me that he's just going really up against the stream there, and he keeps coming out with these ideas. I mean, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, you know, threatening Iran in the most coarse way, and then say, oh, I'd like to meet with no condition, preconditions. I mean, the outside looking in finds that very, very confusing. I mean, the Iranians have already said through their aides is that why would we sit down with someone that broke a country that broke a treaty that we just signed only a few years ago? I mean, how does that show the America leading? Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a treaty, and they didn't sign anything, but that's a semantic problem
it's an international agreed. I mean, it's multilateral. It wasn't just with the Americans. Okay, go ahead.
But I think the point you're making is good, and it's correct. But it stops, and I think that's what we have to focus on, is that the goals, his foreign policy goals are, as the professor correctly observed, although I think for reasons different than he observes them, and that is that we are interested in better trade, we are interested in exercising our trade power and to increase American presence and wealth at home, American exceptionalism, America first, through trade treaties, through trade work. as opposed to naked aggression and use of foreign power, which other presidents have used. Obama was soundly criticized on the right for wanting to meet with the Iranians with no preconditions. I find it interesting that my brothers on the right don't have a problem with Trump doing the same thing. I just throw that out as an observation.
But hang on, Michael. I mean, yeah. in the same week, basically threatening hostilities with Iran and then saying you want to meet with preconditions. You don't have to worry about your friends on the left or right. You have to try to figure out what the president is talking about. Okay, that's my point. Okay.
Well, this was the same. No, your point is right, but this is the same tactic we took with North Korea. You know, little Kim, rocket man, blah, blah, blah. You know, terrible person, going to blow you off the face of the earth. You're going to blow us off the face of the earth. Next thing you know, we're meeting in Singapore. This is the art of the deal. This is a part of the tactics of moving forward. This is part of the noise involved in making the deal, in making the negotiation and doing the work. And it's Trump. He's unique. He is rare. He is something we haven't seen before. The swamp can't make head or tail out of him, and nor can anyone else. And this goes back to my earlier point, which was just buckle up, just as you've observed many times, Peter, buckle up, and you're just going to have to wait to see how it boils out. And the swamp will do their best to keep their arm around it. I just don't know how it's going to work out.
Okay, brace for impact. Okay, Inderjeet, let me go back to you here. Yeah. What is the justification for the United States being in Afghanistan? It's not bringing democracy there anymore, apparently. What's the justification for the illegal behavior of the United States in Syria? Is it bringing democracy there anymore? It's not, apparently. So why are they still there? See, I mean, this makes it very patently obvious. It's just brute force beyond international law. This is what Trump is opening up to. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, when we look at the big picture of global change, we have a whole range of new emerging powers, some of which are very, very powerful economically and increasingly powerful militarily. And they're looking around the world for resources, and they're looking to increase their influence in order to protect their lines of communication. China, for example, is building the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is going to be kind of right across from China all the way to Spain and in through the Indian Ocean. You've got non-state actors like ISIS and other organizations also challenging and destabilizing allies and other regimes as well. And I think what really President Trump is trying to do is effectively grapple with the same problem which post-Cold War presidents have tried to outline, which is the whole world environment has changed. The big difference, I think, with President Trump is he doesn't really look at the idea of hegemony, of building an orderly system or an ordered, rules-based system, or rather he wants to open it up, he wants to loosen it up, and he wants to make it more transactional. So I think what he's trying to do is say, look, we've got this big international series of regimes. America's been ripped off, it's paying too much, it has too many large deficits with everybody. And what we're going to do is we're going to flex our national strength and try to renegotiate our position within it and effectively subordinate everybody else.
Okay,
and
well,
that's actually the big grand plan.
Okay, well, again, like I said, it looks like it's going back to the great powers of the 19th century without all of the rhetoric. At least it's more transparent. David, you mentioned Russia. Is it really worth it for Trump to go down this path? We had the Helsinki summit. I was critical of the president's delivery at the press conference, like I was in Singapore as well. It's not his forte. He's got to work on his game there. And then he wanted another summit and then walked it back. The Russians invited him to Moscow. Why is this so important to him? Is it a campaign promise, or is it just, you know, the media hates it when he does it, and that he just pushes back to show that I am president and I'm going to do what I want to do? Well, what is his fascination here? Go ahead, David.
Well, I think there is all kinds of pressure on him to meet with and work with Russia and to not do so and to treat Russia as having attacked the United States and started a war and to engage in war with Russia and everywhere in between. I think that it's appropriate that the United States and Russia, as the major nuclear weapons powers, meet and get rid of those damn things before they destroy us. I think it's critical for the United States and Russia, as two of the nations doing the most to destroy our natural environment, to meet and start reversing those policies.
David,
that's not so much of the agenda. Maybe they
I'm in complete agreement with you, and I'm going to stay with David here.
Yeah.
Why? It seems to me that Trump's engagement with Russia should come out very clear. Twitter is fine with me. I need to deal with Vladimir Putin to sign a new arms control agreement. It's about to expire in 2021. This is what's most important to all of humanity. Why can't he just write that? I mean, that is very straightforward. And you know what, David? It's transactional, what Trump is supposed to be all about. Go ahead, David.
Well, it would make perfect sense. It would fit with some of his agenda, but it is not where he comes from. It's not something he knows anything about. It's not something he's hired anybody to keep around him who would advise him to do. And it's, you know, he's got the U.S. media and the Democrats and half the public screaming at him not to do anything cooperative with Russia, even if it kills us all.
Yeah.
So it's not shocking that he hasn't come out with that position. But he should. He damn well should. And the world and Russia should be pushing him in that direction.
Okay. All right. Michael, I mean, where does he go from this, from his Russia gambit now? I mean, he's put it off until next year. Is that because of the midterms? It's because he can't do anything transactional? Because just like David said, perfect, crystal clear, even trying to save humanity, he's the boogeyman. Donald Trump is evil incarnate, even if he wants to save humanity. That's a problem in the United States. That's a problem with American exceptionalism. 40 seconds to you, Michael, my friend. Last word.
Real quick, and I promise to stay inside my timeline. Trump never telegraphs what he's going to do. He'll make promises in a campaign context. He'll allude to things in a domestic policy context, but he's never going to say up front what he's going to do. It's one of his huge criticisms of his predecessors. And so because he hasn't said it's there, doesn't mean it's not going to be there. And he's had some surprises for him policy-wise of stuff no one expected, but it was always part of his design. And I think that we just have to buckle up and wait.
Well, you know, that's why I call you one of my Donald Trump Sherpers. That was a very good answer. I like that. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, Charlottesville, and in Northwood. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.